actually having a little bit of a problem with my voice today. It's to your advantage. I won't have to. I won't be able to shout at you as much, and it puts the teens in a good place too. I won't be able to holler at them at all this afternoon. I have to kind of pace myself. Early this week, you probably saw, as I did, some news footage of people evacuating their homes in Hawaii because of the active volcano. Those who were forced to evacuate had just a very short amount of time, a few hours or maybe even less, to gather what they could and move to safety. In many cases, they left everything behind except whatever they could put into their car. When they come back, likely to be covered with lava. Now, when you were younger, you probably played the game called Red Hot Lava, and you jumped from one piece of furniture to another until your parents came in the room as you were avoiding the red hot lava on the living room floor. But this is for real. You probably saw footage of that lava flowing and actually, you know, consuming homes and cars and just the whole parts of the neighborhood. It's really a devastating scene. But you've seen other evacuation scenes as well. The California fires earlier this year, the hurricanes last fall down in the southern states. We've seen many of these different events. But it makes me wonder, if I had to quickly gather what was most valuable to me and evacuate my home, what would I try to salvage? What would you look for? If your house was on fire or about to be swallowed up in some kind of a natural disaster, what would you try the hardest to get out and to save? Of course, as you see people interviewed, the first thing that comes to mind, is that first of all, family. The stuff in the house is just stuff, but they're mostly concerned about their family members, and frankly, their pets too, because they're part of the family. I've known a few people whose homes were destroyed by fire, and they expressed that their greatest loss was not the furniture, it wasn't the appliances or the electronics, it was the items that had sentimental value. Those were the items that were truly important to them. Pictures, scrapbooks, handmade gifts that their children and grandchildren had given them on Mother's Day or Father's Day. Those little items that maybe don't have a lot of dollar value, but that are absolutely irreplaceable. So again, what you choose is indicative of what is most important in your life. What we value the most is what we would most likely hope to save and take with us in the event of that kind of an evacuation. Let's consider, and we looked at this a couple of months ago, the evacuation of Israel from Egypt. The evacuation of Israel from Egypt. Maybe we can learn a little bit about their situation. Turn back with me, first of all, to Exodus chapter 11. Exodus chapter 11. And we'll read the first three verses in this chapter. This is toward the end of the series of plagues that God had brought upon Egypt to wear them down to the point where Israel would be released. And the Lord said to Moses in chapter 11, verse 1, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out of here altogether. Speak now in the hearing of the people, and let every man ask from his neighbor and every woman from her neighbor articles of silver and articles of gold. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. So the people were told to gather items from those in Egypt to compensate them for the time that they had been in slavery. Chapter 12, verse 31, picks up this thread. This is after then that final plague, and with it, at the time when they did actually take the items from the Egyptians. Verse 31, Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise, go out from here, from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds and be gone." Verse 33, "And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, 'We shall all be dead.'" They had, in a matter of just a few weeks, probably 6 to 8 weeks was the length of time during which the plagues took place, from the first one through the tenth. And in that very short period of time, they had seen their nation devastated. And they were anxious for these people that they held responsible to have them out of their way, out of their lives. So get rid of them before we're all dead, was their opinion, their feeling. So they took their dough before it was leavened, verse 34. Verse 35, "The children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses and asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they granted them what they requested. They plundered the Egyptians." Now, when you consider what happened here, these valuable items that the Egyptians gave to the Israelites actually in large part ended up as being the materials that were used to build the tabernacle. Remember when they were going to build the tabernacle, Moses asked the people to donate their items for the purpose of building the tabernacle. What did they have? Mostly what they had was what they had taken from the Egyptians. So just kind of a passing thought, it seems that God was preparing to build his tabernacle with what had been the wealth of Egypt. One more little bit of irony in the destruction of that nation. But what would you have wanted the Egyptians to give to you? That they opened up their what they had and would offer them to the Israelites. And the Israelites then picked from what the Egyptians made available to them. And they had to make careful choices because, of course, they're traveling by foot. And some of the things that might have had some value were just, frankly, too big to carry away. So they chose what looked good to them and what was valuable to them. Now, we know from Israel's experience that things did not go well. Things went very badly for them after they left the land of Egypt. So we're going to piece all this together in a minute, but for now, let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Something went terribly wrong for the nation of Israel, for the people of Israel, after they left Egypt. And what we're going to talk about today is what it was that went wrong, what it was that caused them to go astray. And we'll see that it has to do with what they found to be of value and what they took from the people of Egypt. But here in 1 Corinthians 10, we're familiar with this, I think. Paul is reminding the people of the journeys of Israel and the lessons that the church can learn from what happened to the people of Israel. Verse 6 says that these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. That was at the core of the problem for the people of Israel. They lusted after things that were evil, and they desired those evil things. Notice verse 7. "Do not become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." The first lesson that Paul brings to light is to not become idolaters. Might sound a bit odd to us that would be the first thing that Paul would mention. Are we idolaters? Is it possible that we would be or could be practicing idolatry? That seems like such an obvious thing to avoid. But I think, as Paul puts here, it's an important lesson for us not to pass quickly over. You're not going to go home tonight and worship a rock or a stick or a man-made image or statue. So why is Paul concerned that we not repeat this mistake that Israel made? The title of the sermon this afternoon is Overcoming Idolatry. We're going to consider this sin of Israel, the sin of idolatry, and find some lessons that we can learn. God told Israel in the very first of the commandments that he gave them, "You shall have no other gods before me." Nothing was to be a god except for the true God. Secondly, he told them not to make any graven image. Certainly nothing that would attempt to duplicate him, but in particular, something that would be worshipped as an image. These two commandments are an expression of our dedicated love to God. We love the one true God, not any imitation, and we don't allow anything else to be more important in our life than the worship of our God. So these first two commandments are kind of related to the issue we're talking about here of idolatry. And we'll see as we continue that it also draws in principles from the 10th commandment, which tells us you shall not covet your neighbor's possessions. That last commandment is one that helps to establish a certain level of security and respect in society and in our lives, that your possessions are yours and we shouldn't have to worry about anybody else desiring to have them, because they belong to you. It's part of that portion of the commandments that teach us how to love one another. And we, as we mentioned, the first two commandments have to do with how we love God, by having no other God before him and by not having any images that represent God that we would in any way worship. So idolatry is an issue that seems to cover more than just one particular point. We see it involved in three of the commandments that are given to us. So let's consider the mistake that Israel made. How was it that they practiced idolatry? Turn back to Amos chapter 5. Amos, Hosea, Joel, Amos, one of the easier of the minor prophets to find. Amos chapter 5, and we'll read beginning in verse 22. Amos 5, verse 22. God is speaking to his people here. He says, "Though you offer me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them, nor will I regard your fattened peace offerings." So, we're picking up in the middle of this description of Israel's practice of a false form of religion. They were offering things to God, but they were not done in a right way and not in a way that he accepted. Verse 23, "Take away from me the noise of your songs, for I will not hear the melody of your stringed instruments. But let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream." They were going through certain motions, but they weren't living it. They didn't live justly. They didn't live in righteousness. Verse 25, "Did you offer me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness for 40 years, O house of Israel?" They had a form of worship even in the wilderness. But notice verse 26, "You also carried Succoth, your king, and Chion, your idols, the star of your gods, which you made for yourselves." When Israel came from Egypt, whether they took these idols as part of the loot that they got from the people of Egypt, or whether they were already in their possession, it's clear that the Israelites, as they were brought out of Israel by the God who revealed himself to them, brought along with them their graven images. When they evacuated, one of the things they brought with them were their idols. That they would bring these idols with them reveals a deep weakness that they had. We know from their history, and we can understand better why it unfolded this way when we realize that the Israelites brought these idols with them as they escaped. They never fully accepted or trusted God. Yahweh, who had revealed himself to them, the God of their forefathers, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the true God was never one that they trusted fully. They continued to look to the gods of Egypt, even as they came out of Egypt. This weakness or mistake is also mentioned in other references here. Turn to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel, the 20th chapter. Verse 5. This is, again, God is speaking to the people of Judah in particular, who were in captivity at this time in Babylon. Say to them, now we're jumping a lot of time into the future here, to the time after Israel was established, then they went into captivity ultimately in Babylon, and this is a statement that God makes to them in that setting. Say to them, thus says the Lord God, verse 5, on the day when I chose Israel and raised my hand in an oath to the descendants of the house of Jacob and made myself known to them in the land of Egypt, I raised my hand in an oath and said, I am the Lord your God. God, in effect, swore his allegiance to the people of Israel when he made the oath and took the covenant that was made between God and Israel. On that day, verse 6, I raised my hand in an oath to them to bring them out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had searched out for them, flowing with milk and honey, the glory of all the lands. This was a very special place that God had reserved for his people. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob lived in that territory, but they never owned a foot of land in that region, in that area. God was saving it and preserving it for his nation, for his people. And he brought them out to give it to them. Verse 8, but they rebelled against me and would not obey me. They did not cast away all the abominations which were before their eyes, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. They never got past the idolatry. They never submitted themselves to the one true God as he revealed himself to them. The descendants of Jacob, or Israel, had lived in Egypt for generations. And they had fallen into the worship of the false gods of Egypt. For that generation that left Egypt when God rescued them, all they had known in their lifetime until those previous few weeks had been the gods of Egypt. Now, perhaps there was some historical understanding or remembrance of Joseph and of his father Jacob, but they certainly had no relationship with the one true God. And in fact, Moses had to reveal who it was, who God was, had to be revealed to them. Yet they never did have a relationship with God. And he began to establish one with them at the time he brought them from that land. You go back to Exodus chapter 3 and see where Moses introduced God to them. We'll note here, just as a short passage, chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. Moses said to God, "Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' they'll say, 'What is his name?' They don't know who that God is. And God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said, 'Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you.'" And so God revealed himself to that nation, or the people he was going to form into the nation. But you know, the people of Israel, as I said, had grown up for generations in this pagan, polytheistic society. They believed in many gods. Yahweh was just one more god. He was one more in a list of gods that they had come to consider or to believe in. Chapter 32 in Exodus, jumping ahead to after, again, they've been taken out from the land. This story kind of seems amazing in a sense, because just a few short weeks after Israel left Egypt, they made the golden calf. Exodus chapter 32. The people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain. He was up there for almost 6 weeks. And he was on the mountain. He was receiving the tablets of the law from God. But the people got restless. And when they got restless, and when they got a little bit anxious, a little bit confused, who did they turn to? They didn't turn to Yahweh. They didn't turn to the God who had rescued them from Egypt. They didn't turn to the one who had performed all those incredible miracles and brought them into the wilderness. They turned to what they were used to. They turned to what they really believed in. They went back to their roots. The people gathered to Aaron and they said, "Let us make gods who will go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." And you read the story, they gathered some donations and they built this golden calf. Now, cattle were worshipped, of course, in Egypt, and they were among the most highly worshipped or honored gods in the land of Egypt. And so they fashioned this idol, this pagan god. And notice at the end of verse 4, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Now, again, if we look at it from our perspective, we wonder how foolish could they have been? How could they have been so ignorant as to think that that's what they should do or that is what they should worship? But the point is, they never got it. They never understood. They never accepted Yahweh as their God. They never recognized him or worshiped him. And you know what? As they walked through the Red Sea with the walls of water on each side, scampering across to get from Egypt out and into the wilderness where God was leading them, guess what they were carrying? Their pagan idols. They were carrying their pagan idols with them as they walked that route. And frankly, they probably were praying to those idols as they were making their way through, because they were certainly very frightened and concerned and worried about what was happening. Now it says in Exodus that when they got to the other side, they worshipped and honored God and they believed in him. But that lasted a very short time because it was not genuine. It was at the moment they realized that something, their lives had been spared, but they didn't truly internalize a worship of the God who had revealed himself to them. Let's look at one more example. Ezekiel again, chapter 20. Ezekiel, the 20th chapter. Idolatry was one of the chief sins of the people of Israel. And idolatry led to immorality, as we see back in Exodus 32. That led them to dance and to party and to worship and to carry on in the very very immoral and filthy ways that those pagan gods were worshipped. So that sin led to other sins, which led ultimately to their downfall because they never trusted, never believed in God. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 15. Ezekiel 20, verse 15. Again, this is the same chapter we read from earlier. God is speaking to the people of Judah as they were in Jerusalem in captivity. It says, I also raised my hands in an oath to them, that is to Israel, in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, the glory of all the lands. Remember, when they first came to the borders of Canaan, the first time, they refused to go in because they were afraid of the people. They didn't think that their God, whom they really never had faith in, was strong enough to protect them from those people and their gods. And so they rejected the promise that God had given to them that they would be able to conquer that land. Now, again, just kind of a little bit of background, consider that at that point, Yahweh had been their God, leading them through the wilderness for about 16 months. It took about 16 months from when they came out of Egypt to when they first came to the land of Canaan and had the opportunity to go into the land. During that time, Israel made a covenant with God. Israel was given instruction by God. You find in the book of Leviticus how to be his nation, what kind of laws they were to obey, what promises were given to them. He gave them the structure that they needed. He was teaching them how to be a nation, how to be his people. And he took the period of time that was necessary for them to receive that training. When they came to the land of promise, though, they balked. They were afraid to go in. Why? Continue reading here in Ezekiel 20. But I, verse 16, because they despised my judgments and did not walk in my statutes, but profaned my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols. Their heart was still going after the false gods that they carried with them out of Egypt. They never left that worship behind. They never broke their dependence on the false gods. And because of that, they didn't trust the true God who had given them these promises. So let's, with that in mind, consider some New Testament principles that we can learn from what Israel did, these mistakes that they made. Turn to Acts chapter 7. Acts, the seventh chapter, is mostly a summary of the message that Stephen gave to the Sanhedrin just before he was martyred, before he was killed. And in this chapter, he recounts some of the history of Israel and some of the main events. And he includes some discussion of Israel coming out of Egypt. We'll pick it up in verse 37. Speaking to the Sanhedrin council, Stephen says, "This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. You shall hear.' This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles given to us." So he's leading up to this point he's making about the God of Israel being the one who was with the people of Israel as they came through the wilderness. Verse 39, whom our fathers would not obey, but rejected. And in their hearts, they turned back to Egypt. In their hearts, they turned back to Egypt. They never really wanted to follow the God who had revealed himself to them. They never escaped their spiritual bondage. They escaped Egypt because God brought them out, basically forced them out of Egypt. But they never escaped spiritual bondage to the false gods of Egypt. So here's the challenge to us. Have we fully escaped the spiritual bondage to the false gods of this world? Have we learned the lesson that Israel's failure? Have we escaped the spiritual bondage to the false gods of the world we live in? Now, again, we can look at it very quickly and superficially and say, well, yeah, sure, I don't have an idol in my living room or in my backyard. So obviously I don't practice idolatry. Good. I'm glad we don't. But there's more to it. As we understand. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Paul is expressing here his concern that the people in the church not be deceived by false teaching, be led astray. But verse 3, he draws a contrast between those who are in the church and those who don't have the understanding. So he says, even if our gospel is veiled, that is, if what we teach is not understood, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In other words, to those who haven't been given the understanding that we have, that you have. Verse 4, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. The God of this age has blinded mankind. And we have come out of that world that the God of this world, or that have come out of what the God of this world dominates, where he rules. Israel never grew out of the influence of the gods of their age. We live in a world that is dominated by the false god, Satan. He has deceived all mankind. Even though we've come to know him, that is Satan, for who he is, we still have come out of a world that is influenced thoroughly by him. We live in his world, and we are still subject to his powerful influence. We need not give in to it, but we also must not assume that because of what we know, we're immune from his influence. Again, comparing that to the people of Israel who grew up in that pagan society and whose lives were influenced by that background. Jesus addresses this in principle in Luke chapter 14, verse 33. Luke 14, verse 33. This is a principle that we are familiar with. Luke 14, verse 33. It's in a section that we always review with those that we are preparing for baptism, because it has to do with the commitment that it takes for us to become a disciple of Jesus Christ. We'll just read the conclusion here. Luke 14, verse 33. Likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. We cannot be a disciple of Jesus Christ if we in any sense are carrying idols with us as we travel along the way. We know the principle. anything that becomes more important to us than the true God, in effect, is a false God. Anything that comes between us, anything that becomes more important, becomes a false God. And with that happens, then we, in effect, are allowing a false God to dominate us. The false God, of course, is Satan, but he has many different ways to attempt to influence and to burden people with misunderstanding and by twisting the truth. We don't worship any graven images, for sure, but sometimes there are things that can become our gods. There are things that can come between us and prevent us from truly and fully worshiping our God. Jesus said, if we're going to be a faithful disciple, then nothing in this world can be more important to us or more valuable than him. Now, we're a long ways ahead of the people of Israel, for sure. The understanding that we have, the Holy Spirit working within us, gives us a connection to God that changes everything in our lives. But it's still important for us to remember who the God of this world is, who's out there at work, influencing so much around us. I learned an acronym the other day. It's one that you may be familiar with already, but it was new to me. And I think it can help us understand how it is that people decide what's important to them. I'm talking about people in a very general sense, and it could include us, or it doesn't have to include us, but just there are things, there are influences that we all deal with that help us or cause us to make certain kinds of decisions or choices in life. I think this is a condition that everyone in one way or another struggles with. And it's a condition that mankind has always had to deal with, but it's become exaggerated by technology. It's become a stronger influence because of the technology that we are accustomed to. And since it involves technology, it probably is more of a challenge for our teens and young adults than it is even for some of the rest of us. The condition is called FOMO. Maybe you've heard of that. Anybody heard of FOMO? Yeah, some of you are aware of that. I think it's a condition that we all have to deal with. FOMO is an acronym for the phrase fear of missing out. Fear of missing out. Here's a definition of FOMO. It's a pervasive apprehension that others might be having rewarding experiences from which one is absent. In other words, it's an apprehension that other people are having more fun than I am. It's a concern that I'm missing out on something that I could be enjoying. That can be an influence in our lives that isn't necessarily a positive one. For example, you look at Facebook or other social media, and you see what everybody else is doing. Everybody else is involved in certain kinds of activities or certain kinds of, or they're pursuing certain kinds of items that they find enjoyable. They put up their pictures and it all looks so fun, it all looks so exciting, it all looks so inviting, and we begin to feel like, I'm not doing that. I'm missing out on something. If you aren't doing or having an experience that others have that looks so appealing, then you're missing out. Now, I'm not going to get worried about the pros and the cons of social media. I think we all understand that there are good things about it and there are dangerous things about it. There are things that we need to avoid and things that are very helpful and very practical. I left it at my chair, but I got a cell phone, and I'm nervous when it's way over there and I'm over here. we feel attached to technology. And if we're separated from it, then we do begin to have a little bit of withdrawal. Frankly, for me, my smartphone is pretty much just a telephone. It's pretty boring, but that's how I use it. I use it for a telephone. I like some of the apps. I like the GPS. Check the weather forecast. Check the pirate scores. There's some things on that I like to do to play a bit with my phone. But for me, it's mostly just a communications tool, just for phone calls, oddly enough. But again, one of the potential hazards of social media is that it can make everyone else's life seem more exciting than ours. And it can draw us to things that maybe wouldn't be so healthy. Here's another, this quote, this definition continues, the definition of FOMO. It says, this social anxiety is characterized by a desire to stay continually connected with what others are doing. FOMO is a fear of regret, which may lead to a compulsive concern that one might miss an opportunity for social interaction or a novel experience or other satisfying events. So again, it's a tendency that is natural to us as humans, that is magnified by technology, because now we can be continually connected. Now we can keep track of all the different things that are going on out there. And that kind of information that we might find interesting is one reason why people can literally become addicted to their telephones. They can't put it down because there's something they might miss. So that's why I say that FOMO may particularly affect young adults and teens, because they're the most connected. They're the ones that are best at using that technology and possibly could be influenced by it in a negative way. But frankly, a lot of older people are just as addicted to their devices as younger ones are. It's not new, really. Before cell phones and tablets, we just called it keeping up with the Joneses. You know, we found out our neighbors down the street had something we didn't have, and so we began to want to have that. Or maybe it's a form of peer pressure. At any rate, envy of what others have wasn't created by Facebook or social media. It's part of one of the weaknesses of human nature. My point, though, is that FOMO, or whatever we might call that condition, can lead us to compromise our beliefs. It is an influence from the God of this world that can intrude into our lives and cause us to want to be involved with or to have or to be a part of something so that we're not left out. We may make other things in that, if we follow that line of thought, more important than honoring God and living by his ways, for the fear of not being left out. I will say one thing, though, that there is a fear of missing out that should be part of our thinking, part of our lives. Turn with me to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. This is not a social pressure, but it is a fear of missing out that frankly should be part of our thinking. Philippians chapter 2, verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. And Paul was in prison at this time. He's writing a letter to the church at Philippi, thanking them for their obedience when he was with them, but now it's even more important that they continue when he's not there. But he says, what you should do then, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Work it out with fear and trembling. Why should we have fear and tremble as we work out our salvation? Well, the fear that's mentioned here is a matter of reverence and worship and honoring God. It's a matter of recognizing how important it is that we have this opportunity to be a part of what God is and what God is doing. And it ought to strike in us a fear of missing out, a fear of not wanting to let this opportunity get away, so that it inspires or motivates us to more fully and more completely follow God and to work out salvation. Doesn't mean that we earn salvation, but we work at it and we work to stay separated from the world in which we live so that we're not overly influenced by it. It doesn't become anything in that world, doesn't become a god to us. That's a familiar passage in 1 John chapter 2 that reminds us, again, of staying focused on what is important. Not to be drawn away by the god of this world into the things of this world. Not to allow Satan to have that influence in our lives. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or the things of the world. If we love what the world has to offer, as opposed to what God has to offer, then we certainly are involved in what, in principle, as Paul is speaking of it, would be called idolatry. We're worshiping a different god. We're allowing ourselves to be influenced by the god of this world. There's a lot in the world that's appealing. There's a lot in this world that we would enjoy. There's a lot in this world that could be tempting to us. But the very specific warning is, don't love what the world has to offer. If anyone does, the love of the Father is not in him. If anyone does, they're making the same mistake Israel did, because they clung to their idols rather than serving and trusting in the one true God. The world has a lot to offer, verse 16. The lust of the flesh. The lust of the flesh describes what is naturally desirable to us. Many of our natural appetites or desires are a matter of selfish pleasure. They aren't necessarily of themselves wrong, but they can, if they're out of proportion in our lives, just desiring physical pleasure and physical good things, then that can draw us away, put a barrier between us and God. Lust of the flesh. Lust of the eyes. It's called Amazon.com. So much that you didn't think you needed until you went to that website. Lust of the eyes, the stuff that we see that we would like to enjoy or to have as part of this fear of missing out, of the things that we desire, the power of advertising, the power of influence, the powers of what other people around us seem to have. By nature, we're drawn to it. John calls it the lust of the eyes. And the third warning he gives is against the pride of life. Our own self-will, our own independence, our own illusion of independence and strength, our own desire for what we want to accomplish in life, those are things that can get in our way. Those are things that can become part of this general principle of idolatry. Verse 17, the world is passing away and the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. These are the false gods. These are the gods who have no power, who have nothing to offer to us except what seems to be something we can enjoy in the moment. And if we love what that world has to offer to us and devote ourselves to it, then we make the same mistake Israel did by lacking true love for God. These false gods will eventually be destroyed. That's the whole, one of the points of the story of Egypt. God completely dismantled the nation of Egypt in just a few weeks. They went from the most powerful nation on earth to total destruction as God cleaned them out through those plagues. The false gods of this society will be destroyed. Lasting value and success comes only from the one true God. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Kind of go back toward where we started. 1 Timothy chapter 6. What should we be collecting? What should we be gathering that's important to us? Not necessarily at the moment in the face of disaster, but what we identify that is the most important to us defines the relationship we have with God. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6 says that godliness with contentment is great gain. That's a short statement, but it sure says a lot, doesn't it? To live in a godly way and to be content is really the best way for us to live. To be content is a very challenging for us as humans. To be content, of course, means to be satisfied, to be pleased with what we have. But human nature doesn't tend to be satisfied, doesn't tend to be content. Contentment is a very difficult frame of mind to maintain. We might be perfectly content, and then in a moment we can see something that we don't have yet that we really can't live without, because now we've seen that it's out there or somebody else has it. Verse 7. We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. What would you gather up to take with you if you knew it was your last day? If you knew you had to leave? If you knew you were evacuating? What would you gather to take with you? Paul says, look, didn't have nothing when you got here, and you ain't going to have nothing when you leave. So what happens to all that stuff? What's really important? So having food and clothing, we should be content. Having what we need, having the necessities, he says we should be content. Satan creates an environment, at least where we live, in this, in our society here in this part of the world, he creates an environment where we never, ever have enough. There's always something else. And frankly, that's part of our own nature anyway, but Satan plays right into it and gives us that sense that we don't have enough. But those who desire to be rich, those who desire those things that they can have, that have these false gods that they worship, fall into temptation and a snare, into foolish and harmful lusts, which drowned men in destruction and perdition. In other words, he's saying that those kinds of giving into those gods will ruin a person's life. This destroys them. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. So, all right, we see that. It's not a new thought for us to have. We realize that physical items we might accumulate, the money it takes to buy them, is not really what life is about. But what is life about? We're back to that question. What should you take with you? What should you gather and bring along with you as you move forward? What would you take with you? If you can't take any items with you, as Paul said in verse 6, what can you take with you? Verse 11. But you, O man of God, see, don't go after the wealth. Don't go after the riches. That ruins people's lives. Don't worry about what you don't have. Be content with what you do have. And you, O man of God, flee those things. And here's what we collect. Here are the items that we gather up into our lives. Here are the things we do take out of this life, because these are matters of character and matters of heart. The physical, the false gods, the idolatrous things that people chase after and worship, they're all going to pass away, John said. They ruin people's lives, is what Paul says to Timothy. Here are the things to pursue. To pursue means to chase down, to track down, to go after. It's not a passive word at all. It means to chase. It means to be determined to find and to get. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith and lay hold on eternal life. Here are the things that we can invest ourselves in that will have genuine and full meaning to us as our lives develop, as they continue. These are the things you will carry out of this world with you as part of your heart and your character. These are the true values that our God has given us the privilege to pursue. Let's conclude with one final verse in Isaiah chapter 44. We learn from what Israel didn't do, the mistake that they made, how they never truly accepted and honored the God who revealed himself to them and who rescued them. Hopefully we can contrast that and have a different relationship with him. Isaiah 44, verse 6, in the New Revised Standard Version. Isaiah 44, verse 6, we'll read through verse 9. Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. I'm the first, and I'm the last, and there is no God beside me. There is no God. In spite of all the false, tempting issues or things that we could worship and chase after, there's no real choice when it comes down to it. There is no God besides your God. Who is like me? Let him proclaim and declare it. Yes, let him recount it to me in order. From the time that I established the ancient nation, and let them declare to them the things that are coming and the events that are going to take place. Only your God can do that. Only your God can proclaim and declare what will happen and brought about what has happened. Do not tremble. Do not be afraid. Have I not long since announced it to you and declared it to you? And you are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? Or is there any other rock? I know of none. Those who fashion a graven image, all of them are futile. A graven image could be a literal statue. A graven image could be something that in our minds takes the place of the true God. Those who fashion a graven image are futile. Their precious things mean nothing. They're of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see or know, and they'll be put to shame. We have the privilege of worshiping the one true, genuine God. Satan has created many false gods in his image. But those gods are nothing, and they can do nothing. And they will ultimately end in humiliation. As Israel's view of and trust in God was compromised by the world they lived in, what about us? Is our view and relationship with God diluted or diminished because of the environment that we live in or have come out of? We can truly and completely forsake the false gods in our lives. So continue to think about it. Consider Paul's warning that we not repeat the mistakes Israel made. What will you take with you from this life? And be reminded that we have our opportunity now to completely overcome idolatry.